no beef with the dam. They're happy with the compensation they're getting from Coastal Electric for their land, and they're looking forward to moving to their new place. Oh, and on Friday at 2:20 p.m., six of the seven men were at a store called Frank's Sporting Weapons in Silver City buying ammunition. Judy shook her head. Well, whose dumb idea was it to raid them anyway? It had been hers, of course. Simon said, "This morning at the briefing, Marvin claimed it was his." Serves him right that it was a flop. Judy frowned. I don't get it. It seemed like such a good lead. Brian has another meeting with Mr. Honeymoon in Sacramento tomorrow afternoon. Looks like he'll go empty-handed.
Mr. Honeymoon won't like that.
I hear he's not a real touchy-feely type guy. Judy smiled grimly. She had no sympathy for Kincaid, but she could not take pleasure in the failure of the raid. It meant the Hammer of Eden were still out there somewhere, planning another earthquake.
Thanks, Simon. See you tomorrow.
As soon as she hung up, the phone rang. It was the switchboard operator at the office.
A Professor Quercus called with a message he said was urgent. He has some important news for you.
Judy debated calling Marvin and passing the message to him, but she was too curious to know what Michael had to say. She dialed his home. When he answered, she could hear the soundtrack of a TV cartoon in the background. Dusty was still there, she guessed.
"This is Judy Maddox," she said.
"Hi, how are you?" She raised her eyebrows. A weekend with Dusty had mellowed him out.
"I'm fine, but I'm off the case," she said.
"I know that. I've been trying to reach the guy who's taken over, man with a name like a soul singer."
"Marvin Hayes."
"Right. Like Dancing in the Grapevine by Marvin Hayes and the Haystacks." Judy laughed. Michael said, "But he doesn't return my calls, so I'm stuck with you." That was more like Michael.
"Okay, what have you got?
Can you come over? I really need to show you." She found herself pleased, even a little excited at the thought of seeing him again.
"Do you have any more Cap'n Crunch?"
"I think there's a little left."
"Okay, I'll be there in 15 or 20 minutes.
She hung up.
"I have to go see my seismologist," she said to Beau. "Shall I drop you at the bus stop?"
"I can't ride the bus like Jim Rockford. I'm a San Francisco detective."
"So, you're a human being?"
"Yeah, but the street guys don't know that."
"They don't know you're human?"
"To them, I'm a demigod." He was kidding, but there was some truth in it, Judy knew. He had been putting hoodlums behind bars in this city for almost 30 years. Every kid on a street corner with vials of crack in the pockets of his bomber jacket was afraid of Beau Maddox.
"So you want to ride to Berkeley with me?"
"Sure, why not? I'm curious to meet your handsome seismologist."
She made a U-turn and headed for the Bay Bridge.
"What makes you think he's handsome?"
He grinned.
"From the way you talk to him," he said smugly.
"You shouldn't use cop psychology on your own family."
"Cop schmop, you're my daughter, I can read your mind."
"Well, you're right, he's a hunk, but I don't much like him."
"You don't?" Beau sounded skeptical.
"He's arrogant and difficult. He's better when his kid's around, that softens him."
"He's married?"
"Separated."
"Separated as married." Judy could sense Beau losing interest in Michael. It felt like a drop in the temperature. She smiled to herself. He was still eager to marry her off, but he had old-fashioned scruples. They reached Berkeley and drove down Euclid Street. There was an orange Subaru parked in Judy's usual space under the magnolia tree. She found another slot. When Michael opened the door of his apartment, Judy thought he looked strained.
"Hi, Michael," she said. "This is my father, Beau Maddox."
"Come in," Michael said abruptly. His mood seemed to have changed in the short time it had taken to drive here. When they entered the living room, Judy saw why. Dusty was on the couch, looking terrible. His eyes were red and watering, and his eyeballs seemed swollen. His nose was running, and he was breathing noisily. A cartoon was playing on TV, but he was hardly paying attention. Judy knelt beside him and touched his hair.
"Poor Dusty," she said. "What happened?"
"He gets allergy attacks," Michael explained.
"Did you call the doctor?"
"No need. I've given him the drug he needs to suppress the reaction."
How fast does it work?
It's already working. He's past the worst. But he may stay like this for days.
I wish I could do something for you, little man, Judy said to Dusty.
A female voice said, I'll take care of him, thank you. Judy stood up and turned around. The woman who had just walked in looked as if she had stepped off a couturier's catwalk. She had a pale oval face and straight red hair that fell past her shoulders. Although she was tall and thin, her bust was generous and her hips curvy. Her long legs were clad in close-fitting tan jeans, and she wore a fashionable lime-green top with a V-neck. Until this moment, Judy had felt smartly dressed in khaki shorts, tan loafers that showed off her pretty ankles, and a white polo shirt that gleamed against her café au lait skin. Now she felt dowdy, middle-aged, and out of date by comparison with this vision of street chic. And Michael was bound to notice that Judy had a big ass and small tits by comparison.
This is Melanie, Dusty's mom, Michael said.
Melanie, meet my friend Judy Maddox.
Melanie nodded curtly.
So that's his wife.
Michael had not mentioned the FBI. Did he want Melanie to think Judy was a girlfriend?
This is my father, Beau Maddox, Judy said.
Melanie did not trouble to make small talk.
I was just leaving, she said.
She was carrying a small duffel bag with a picture of Donald Duck on the side, obviously Dusty's. Judy felt put down by Michael's tall, voguish wife. She was annoyed with herself for the reaction.
Why should I give a damn?
Melanie looked around the room and said, Michael, where's the rabbit?
Here. Michael picked up a grubby, soft toy from his desk and gave it to her.
She looked at the child on the couch.
This never happens in the mountains, she said coldly.
Michael looked anguished.
What am I going to do, not see him?
We'll have to meet somewhere out of town.
I want him to stay with me. It's not the same if he doesn't sleep over.
If he doesn't sleep over, he won't get like this.
I know, I know.
Judy's heart went out to Michael. He was obviously in distress, and his wife was so cold.
Melanie stuffed the rabbit into the Donald Duck bag and closed the zip.
We have to go.
I'll carry him to your car.
Michael picked up Dusty from the couch.
Come on, Tiger, let's go.
When they had left, Beau looked at Judy and said, Wow, unhappy families.
She nodded, but she liked Michael better than before. She wanted to put her arms around him and say, You're doing your best. No one can do more.
He's your type, though, Beau said.
I have a type?
You like a challenge.
That's because I grew up with one.
Me? He pretended to be outraged. I spoiled you rotten.
She pecked his cheek.
You did, too.
When Michael returned, he was grim-faced and preoccupied. He did not offer Judy and Beau a drink or a cup of coffee, and he had forgotten all about Captain Crunch. He sat at his computer.
Look at this, he said without preamble.
Judy and Beau stood behind him and looked over his shoulder. He put a chart on the screen. Here's the seismograph of the Owens Valley tremor with the mysterious preliminary vibrations I couldn't understand, remember?
I sure do, Judy said.
Here's a typical earthquake of about the same magnitude. This has normal foreshocks. See the difference?
Yes.
The normal foreshocks were uneven and sporadic, whereas the Owens Valley vibrations followed a pattern that seemed too regular to be natural. Now look at this. He brought a third chart up on the screen. It showed a neat pattern of even vibrations, just like the Owens Valley chart.
What made those vibrations? Judy said.
A seismic vibrator, Michael announced triumphantly.
Beau said, What the hell is that?
Judy almost said, I don't know, but I think I want one. She smothered a grin.
Michael said, It's a machine used by the oil industry to explore underground. Basically, it's a huge jackhammer mounted on a truck. It sends vibrations through the Earth's crust.
And those vibrations triggered the earthquake?
I don't think it can be a coincidence.
Judy nodded solemnly.
That's it, then. They really can cause earthquakes.
She felt a cold chill descend as the news sank in.
Beau said, Jesus, I hope they don't come to San Francisco.
Or Berkeley, said Michael. You know, although I told you it was possible, I never really believed it in my heart until now.
Judy said, the Owens Valley tremor was quite minor.
Michael shook his head. We can't take comfort from that. The size of the earthquake bears no relation to the strength of the triggering vibration. It depends on the pressure in the fault. The seismic vibrator could trigger anything from a barely perceptible tremor to another Loma Prieta.
Judy remembered the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989 as vividly as if it were last night's bad dream.
Shit, she said. What are we going to do?
Bo said, you're off the case.
Michael frowned, puzzled. You told me that, he said to Judy, but you didn't say why.
Office politics, Judy said. We have a new boss who doesn't like me, and he reassigned the case to someone he prefers.
I don't believe this, Michael said. A terrorist group is causing earthquakes, and the FBI is having a family spat about who gets to chase after them.
What can I tell you? Do scientists let personal squabbles get in the way of their search for the truth?
Michael gave one of his sudden, unexpected grins. You bet your ass they do. But listen, surely you can pass on this information to Marvin whatever.
When I told my boss about Los Alamos, he ordered me not to interfere again.
This is incredible, Michael said, becoming angry. You can't just ignore what I've told you.
Don't worry, I won't do that, Judy said curtly. Let's keep cool and think for a moment. What's the first thing we need to do with this information? If we can find out where the seismic vibrator came from, we may have a lead on the Hammer of Eden.
Right, Bo said. Either they bought it, or more likely they stole it.
Judy asked Michael, how many of these machines are there in the continental United States? 100? 1,000?
In there somewhere, he said.
Anyhow, not many, so the people who manufacture them probably have a record of every sale. I could track them down tonight, get them to make a list, and if the truck was stolen, it may be listed on the National Crime Information Center.
The NCIC, run by FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., could be accessed by any law enforcement agency.
Bo said, the NCIC is only as good as the information that's put in. We don't have a license plate for this, and there's no telling how it might be categorized on the computer. I could have the San Francisco PD put out a multi-state query on the CLETS computer.
CLETS was the California Law Enforcement Telecommunications System.
And I could get the newspapers to print a picture of one of these trucks, get members of the public looking out for it.
Wait a minute, Judy said. If you do that, Kincaid will know I'm behind it.
Michael rolled his eyes in an expression of despair.
Bo said, not necessarily. I won't tell the papers that this is connected with the Hammer of Eden. I'll just say we're looking for a stolen seismic vibrator. It's kind of an unusual auto theft. They'll like the story.
Great, Judy said. Michael, can I have a printout of the three graphs?
Sure.
He touched a key and the printer whirred.
Judy put a hand on his shoulder. His skin was warm through the cotton of his shirt.
I sure hope Dusty feels better, she said.
He covered her hand with his own.
Thanks.
His touch was light, his palm dry. She felt a frisson of pleasure. Then he took his hand away and said, maybe you should give me your pager number so I can reach you a little faster if necessary. She took out a business card. After a moment's thought, she wrote her home number on it before giving it to him.
Michael said, after you two have made these phone calls...
He hesitated.
Would you like to meet for a drink or maybe dinner? I'd really like to hear how you get on.
Not me, Bo said. I have a bowling match.
Judy, how about you?
Is he asking me for a date?
I was planning to visit someone in hospital, she said.
Michael looked crestfallen. Judy realized that there was not a thing she would rather do this evening than have dinner with Michael Quirkus.
But I guess that won't take me all night, she said.
Okay, sure.
It was only a week since Milton Lestrange's cancer had been diagnosed, but already he looked thinner and older. Perhaps it was the effect of the hospital setting, the instruments, the bed, the white sheets. Or maybe it was the baby blue pajamas that revealed a triangle of pale chest below the neck. He had lost all his power symbols, his big desk, his Mont Blanc fountain pen, his striped silk tie. Judy was shocked to see him like this.
"Gee, Milt, you don't look so great," she blurted. He smiled.
"I knew you wouldn't lie to me, Judy."
She felt embarrassed.
"I'm sorry, it just came out."
"Don't blush.
You're right. I'm in bad shape."
"What are they doing?"
"They'll operate this week. They haven't said what day. But that's just to bypass the obstruction in the bowel. The outlook is poor."
"What do you mean, poor?"
90% of cases are fatal."
Judy swallowed.
"Jesus, Milt." "I may have a year."
"I don't know what to say."
He did not dwell on the grim prognosis. "Sandy, my first wife, came to see me yesterday. She told me you had called her."
"Yeah, I had no idea whether she'd want to see you, but I figured at least she'd like to know you were in the hospital."
He took Judy's hand and squeezed it.
"Thank you. Not many people would have thought of that. I don't know how you got to be so wise, so young."
"I'm glad she came."
Milt changed the subject.
"Take my mind off my troubles. Tell me about the office."
"Oh, you shouldn't be concerning yourself."
"Hell, I won't. Work doesn't worry you much when you're dying. I'm just curious."
"Well, I won my case. The Fung brothers are probably going to spend most of the next decade in jail."
"Well done.
You always had faith in me."
"I knew you could do it."
"But Brian Kincaid recommended Marvin Hayes as the new supervisor."
"Marvin? Shit. Brian knows you were supposed to get that job."
"Tell me about it."
"Marvin's a tough guy, but slipshod. He cuts corners."
"I'm baffled," Judy said. "Why does Brian rate him so high? What is it with those two? Are they lovers or something?"
Milt laughed.
"No, not lovers. But one time years ago, Marvin saved Brian's life."
"No kidding."
"It was a shootout. I was there. We ambushed a boat unloading heroin on Sonoma Beach up in Marin County. It was early one morning in February, and the sea was so cold it hurt. There was no jetty, so the bad guys were stacking kilos of horse on a rubber dinghy to bring them ashore. We let them land the entire cargo, then we moved in."
Milt sighed, and a faraway look came into his blue eyes. It occurred to Judy that he would never see another Dawn ambush.
After a moment, he went on. "Brian made a mistake. He let one of them get too close to him. This little Italian grabbed him and pointed a gun at his head. We all had our weapons out, but if we shot the Italian, he would probably have pulled the trigger before he died. Brian was really scared."
Milt lowered his voice. "He pissed himself. We could see the stain on his suit pants. But Marvin was as cool as the devil himself. He starts walking toward Brian and the Italian. 'Shoot me instead,' he says. 'It won't make any difference.' I've never seen anything like it. The Italian fell for it. He swung his gun arm round to aim at Marvin. In that split second, five of our people shot the guy."
Judy nodded. It was typical of the stories that agents told after a few beers in Everton's. But she did not dismiss it as macho bravado. FBI agents did not often get involved in shootouts. They never forgot the experience. She could imagine that Kincaid felt intensely close to Marvin Hayes after that.
"Well, that explains the trouble I've been having," she said. "Brian gave me a bullshit assignment, and then when it turned out to be important, he took it from me and gave it to Marvin."
Milt sighed.
"I could intervene, I guess. I'm still sacked, technically. But Kincaid is an experienced office politician, and he knows I'm never coming back. He'd fight me. And I'm not sure I have the energy for that."
Judy shook her head. "I wouldn't want you to. I can handle this."
"What's the assignment he gave Marvin?"
"The Hammer of Eden, the people who cause earthquakes."
"The people who say they cause earthquakes."
"That's what Marvin thinks, but he's wrong."
Milt frowned. "Are you serious?"
"Totally."
"What are you going to do?"
"Work the case behind Brian's back."
Milt looked troubled. "That's dangerous."
"Yeah," Judy said, "but not as dangerous as a goddamn earthquake."
Michael wore a navy blue cotton suit over a plain white shirt, open at the neck, and no tie.
Had he thrown on this ensemble without a moment's thought, Judy wondered, or did he realize it made him look good enough to eat? She had changed into a white silk dress with red polka dots. It was about right for a May evening, and she always turned heads when she was wearing it. Michael took her to a small downtown restaurant that served vegetarian Indian dishes. She had never tasted Indian food, so she let him order for her. She put her mobile phone on the table. "I know it's bad manners, but Beau promised to call me if he got any information about stolen seismic vibrators." "Okay by me," Michael said. "Did you call the manufacturers?" "Yeah, I got a sales director at home watching baseball. He promised me a list of purchasers tomorrow. I tried for tonight, but he said it was impossible." She frowned in annoyance. "We don't have much time left. 5 days now." "However, he faxed me a picture." She took a folded sheet of paper from her purse and showed it to him. He shrugged. "It's just a big truck with a piece of machinery on the back." "But after Beau puts this picture out on Pletz, every cop in California will be watching for one. And if the newspapers and TV carry the picture tomorrow, half the population will be on the lookout, too." The food came. It was spicier than she was used to, but delicious. Judy ate with gusto. After a few minutes, she caught Michael looking at her with a faint smile. She raised an eyebrow. "Did I say something witty?" "I'm pleased you're enjoying the cuisine." She grinned. "Does it show?" "Yeah." "I'll try to be more dainty." "Please don't. It's a pleasure to watch you. Besides..." "What?" "I like your go-for-it attitude. It's one of the things that attracts me to you. You seem to have a big appetite for life. You like Dusty, and you have a good time hanging out with your dad, and you're proud of the FBI, and you obviously love beautiful clothes. You even enjoy Cap'n Crunch." Judy felt herself flush, but she was pleased. She liked the picture he painted of her. She asked herself what it was about him that had attracted her. It was his strength, she decided. He could be irritatingly stubborn, but in a crisis he would be a rock. This afternoon, when his wife had been so heartless, most men would have quarreled, but he had been concerned only for Dusty. "Plus, I'd really love to get my hands inside his jockey shorts." "Judith, behave." She took a sip of wine and changed the subject. "We're assuming that the Hammer of Eden have data similar to yours about pressure points along the San Andreas Fault." "They must have to pick the locations where the seismic vibrator could trigger an earthquake." "Could you go through the same exercise, study the data, and figure out the best place?" "I guess I could. Probably there would be a cluster of 5 or 6 possible sites." He saw the direction her thoughts were taking. "Then, I suppose, the FBI could stake out the sites and watch for a seismic vibrator." "Yes, if I were in charge." "I'll make the list anyway. Maybe I'll fax it to Governor Robeson." "Don't let too many people see it. You might cause a panic." "But if my forecast turned out to be right, it could give my business a shot in the arm." "Does it need one?" "It sure does. I have one big contract that just about pays the rent and the bill for my ex-wife's mobile phone. I borrowed money from my parents to start the business, and I haven't begun to pay it back. I was hoping to land another major client, Mutual American Insurance."
"I used to work for them years ago, but go on."
"I thought the deal was in the bag, but they're delaying the contract. I guess they're having second thoughts. If they back out, I'm in trouble. But if I predicted an earthquake and turned out to be right, I think they'd sign. Then I'd be comfortable."
"All the same, I hope you'll be discreet. If everyone tries to leave San Francisco at the same time, there'll be riots."
He gave a devil-may-care grin that was infuriatingly attractive. "Got you rattled, haven't I?" She shrugged.
"I'll admit it. My position at the Bureau is vulnerable. If I'm associated with an outbreak of mass hysteria, I don't think I could survive there."
"Is that important to you?"
"Yes and no. Sooner or later I plan to get out and have children, but I want to quit by my timetable, not someone else's."
"Do you have anyone in mind to have the children with?"
"No."
She gave him a candid look.
"A good man is hard to find."
"I imagine there'd be a waiting list."
"What a nice compliment."
"I wonder if you'd join the line.
I wonder if I'd want you to.
He offered her more wine.
No, thanks. I'd like a cup of coffee.
He waved at a waiter.
Being a parent can be painful, but you never regret it.
Tell me about Dusty.
He sighed.
I have no pets, no flowers in the apartment, very little dust because of my computers. All the windows are closed tight and the place is air-conditioned. But we walked down to the bookstore, and on the way home he petted a cat. An hour later he was the way you saw him.
It's too bad, the poor kid.
His mother recently moved to a place in the mountains, up near the Oregon border, and since then he's been okay, until today. If he can't visit me without having an attack, I don't know what we'll do. I can't go and live in fucking Oregon. There aren't enough earthquakes there.
He looked so troubled that she reached across the table and squeezed his hand.
You'll work something out. You love him, that's obvious.
He smiled.
Yeah, I do.
They drank their coffee, and he paid. He walked her to her car.
This evening has gone so fast, he said.
I think the guy likes me.
Good.
Do you want to go to a movie sometime?
The dating game. It never changes.
Yes, I'd like that.
Maybe one night this week?
Sure.
I'll call you.
Okay.
May I kiss you goodnight?
Yes.
She grinned.
Yes, please.
He bent his face to hers. It was a soft, tentative kiss. His lips moved gently against hers, but he did not open his mouth. She kissed him back the same way. Her breasts felt sensitive. Without thinking, she pressed her body against his. He squeezed her briefly, then broke away.
Good night, he said.
He watched her get into her car and waved as she drew away from the curb. She turned a corner and pulled up at a stoplight.
Wow, she said.
On Monday morning, Judy was assigned to a team investigating a militant Muslim group at Stanford University. Her first job was to comb computer records of gun licenses, looking for Arab names to check out. She found it hard to concentrate on a relatively harmless bunch of religious fanatics when she knew the Hammer of Eden were planning their next earthquake. Michael called at 9:05. He said, "How are you, Agent Judy?" The sound of his voice made her feel happy.
I'm fine, real good.
I enjoyed our date. She thought of that kiss, and the corners of her mouth twitched in a private smile. I'll take another of those any time.
Me too.
Are you free tomorrow night?
I guess.
That sounded too cool.
I mean, yes, unless something happens with this case.
Do you know Morton's?
Sure.
Let's meet in the bar at 6, then we can pick a movie together.
I'll be there.
But that was the only bright spot in her morning. By lunchtime, she could no longer contain herself, and she called Beau, but he still had nothing. She called the seismic vibrator manufacturers, who said they had almost completed the list and it would be on her fax machine by the end of the business day.
That's another damn day gone. Now we've only got 4 days to catch these people.
She was too worried to eat. She went to Simon Sparrow's office. He was wearing a natty English-style shirt, blue with pink stripes. He ignored the unofficial FBI dress code and got away with it, probably because he was so good at his job. He was talking on the phone and watching the screen of a wave analyzer at the same time.
This may seem like an odd question, Mrs. Gorky, but would you tell me what you can see from your front window?
As he listened to the reply, he watched the spectrum of Mrs. Gorky's voice, comparing it with a printout he had taped to the side of the monitor. After a few moments, he drew a line through a name on a list.
Thank you for your cooperation, Mrs. Gorky. I don't need to trouble you any further. Goodbye.
Judy said, This may seem like an odd question, Mr. Sparrow, but why do you need to know what Mrs. Gorky sees when she looks out the window?
I don't, Simon said. That question generally elicits a response of about the length I need to analyze the voice. By the time she's finished, I know whether she's the woman I'm looking for.
And who's that?
The one who called the John Truth Show, of course.
He tapped the ring binder on his desk. The Bureau, the police, and the radio stations that syndicate the show have so far received a total of 1,229 calls telling us who she is.
Judy picked up the file and leaped through it. Could the vital clue be in here somewhere?
Simon had got his secretary to collate the tip-off calls. In most cases, there was a name, address, and phone number for the tipster, and the same for the suspect. In some cases, there was a quote from the caller.
I've always suspected she had mob connections.
She's one of those subversive types. I'm not surprised she's involved in something like this.
She seems like a regular mom, but it's her voice, I'd swear on the Bible.
One particularly useless tip gave no name, but said, I know I've heard her voice on the radio or something. It was so sexy I remembered it, but it was a long time ago. Maybe I heard it on a record album.
It was a sexy voice, Judy recalled. She had noticed that at the time. The woman could make a fortune as a telephone salesperson, getting male executives to buy advertising space they did not need.
Simon said, so far today I've eliminated 100 of them. I think I'm going to need some assistance.
Judy continued, leaping through the file.
I'd help you if I could, but I've been warned off the case.
Gee, thanks. That sure makes me feel better.
Do you hear how it's going?
Marvin's team are calling everyone on the mailing list of the Green California campaign. He and Brian just left for Sacramento, but I can't imagine what they're going to tell the famous Mr. Honeymoon.
It's not the goddamn Greens. We all know that.
He doesn't have any other ideas, though.
Judy frowned, looking at the file. She had come across another call that mentioned a record. As before, there was no name for the suspect, but the caller had said, I've heard the voice on an album, I'm darn sure. Something from way back, like the 60s.
Judy asked Simon, did you notice that two of the tip-offs mention a record album?
They do? I missed that.
They think they've heard her voice on an old record.
Is that right?
Simon was instantly animated.
It must be a speech album, bedtime stories or Shakespeare or something. A person's speaking voice is quite different from their singing voice.
Roger Kahn passed the door and caught her eye.
Oh, Judy, your father called. I thought you were at lunch.
Suddenly, Judy felt breathless. She left Simon without a word and rushed back to her desk. Without sitting down, she picked up the phone and dialed Beau's number. He picked up right away.
Lieutenant Maddox here.
What have you got?
A suspect.
Jesus, that's great.
Get this. A seismic vibrator went missing 2 weeks ago somewhere between Shiloh, Texas and Clovis, New Mexico. The regular driver disappeared at the same time and his burned-out car was found at the local dump, containing what appeared to be his ashes.
He was murdered for his damn truck?
These people don't take prisoners, do they? The prime suspect is one Richard Granger, aged 48. They called him Ricky, and they thought he was Hispanic, but with a name like that, he could be a Caucasian with a tan. And, wait for it, he has a record.
You're a genius, Beau.
A copy should be coming out of your fax machine about now. He was a big-time hoodlum in L.A. around the late 60s, early 70s in there. Convictions for assault, burglary, grand theft auto. Questioned about three murders, also drug dealing. But he disappeared from the scene in 1972. The LAPD thought he must have been whacked by the mob. He owed them money, but they never found a body, so they didn't close the file.
I get it. Ricky ran from the mob, got religion, and started a cult.
Unfortunately, we don't know where.
Except that it's not in Silver River Valley.
The LAPD can check out his last known address. It's probably a waste of time, but I'll ask them anyway. Guy in homicide there owes me a favor.
Do we have a picture of Ricky?
There's one in the file, but it's a photo of a 19-year-old. He's pushing 50 now. He probably looks completely different. Luckily, the sheriff in Shiloh prepared an EFIT likeness. EFIT was the computer program that had replaced the old-style police artist. He promised to fax it to me, but it hasn't arrived yet.
Refax it to me as soon as you get it, would you?
Sure. What'll you do?
I'm going to Sacramento.
It was 4:15 when Judy stepped through the door that had Governor carved in it.
The same secretary sat behind the big desk. She recognized Judy and registered surprise.
"You're one of the FBI people, aren't you? The meeting with Mr. Honeymoon started 10 minutes ago."
"That's okay," Judy said. "I've brought some important information that came in at the last moment. But before I go into the meeting, did a fax arrive here for me within the last few minutes?"
Having left her office before the E-5 picture of Ricky Granger came through, she had called Beau from the car and asked him to fax it to the governor's office.
"I'll check."
She spoke into the phone.
"Yes, your fax is here."
A moment later, a young woman appeared from a side door with a sheet of paper. Judy stared at the face on the fax. This was the man who might kill thousands, her enemy. She saw a handsome man who had gone to some trouble to hide the true shape of his face, as if perhaps he had anticipated this moment. His head was covered by a cowboy hat. That suggested that the witnesses who had helped the sheriff create the computer picture had never seen the suspect without a hat. Consequently, there was no indication of what his hair was like. If he was bald or grizzled or curly or long-haired, he would look different from this picture. And the bottom half of his face was equally well concealed by a bushy beard and mustache. There could be any kind of jaw under there. By now, she guessed he was clean-shaven. The man had deep-set eyes that stared hypnotically out of the picture. But to the general public, all criminals had staring eyes. All the same, the picture told her some things. Ricky Granger did not habitually wear spectacles. He was evidently not African-American or Asian, and since his beard was dark and luxuriant, he probably had dark hair. From the attached description, she learned that he was about 6 feet tall, slim-built and fit-looking, with no noticeable accent. It was not much, but it was better than nothing. And nothing was what Brian and Marvin had. Honeymoon's assistant appeared and ushered Judy into the horseshoe, where the governor and his staff had their offices. Judy bit her lip. She was about to break the first rule of bureaucracy and make her boss look a fool. It would probably be the end of her career. Screw it. All she wanted now was to make her boss get serious about the Hammer of Eden before they killed people. As long as he did that, he could fire her. They passed the entrance to the governor's personal suite, then the assistant opened the door to Honeymoon's office. Judy stepped inside. For a moment, she allowed herself to enjoy the shock and dismay on the faces of Brian Kincaid and Marvin Hayes. Then she looked at Honeymoon. The cabinet secretary was wearing a pale gray shirt with a subdued black-and-white dotted tie and dark gray patterned suspenders. He looked at Judy with raised eyebrows and said, "Agent Maddox, Mr. Kincaid just got through telling me he took you off the case because you're a ditz." Judy was floored. She was supposed to be in control of this scene. She was the one causing consternation. Honeymoon had outdone her. He was not going to be upstaged in his own office. She recovered fast. "Okay, Mr. Honeymoon, if you want to play hardball, I'll go into bat." She said to him, "Brian's full of shit." Kincaid scowled, but Honeymoon just raised his eyebrows slightly. Judy added, "I'm the best agent he has, and I just proved it."
"You did," Honeymoon said.
"While Marvin has been sitting around with his thumb up his ass, pretending there's nothing to worry about, I've solved this case." Kincaid stood up, his face flushed. He said angrily, "Maddox, just what the hell do you think you're doing here?" She ignored him. "I know who's sending terrorist threats to Governor Robeson," she said to Honeymoon. "Marvin and Brian don't. You can make your own decision about who's the ditz." Hayes was bright red. He burst out, "What the hell are you talking about?" Honeymoon said, "Let's all sit down. Now that Ms. Maddox has interrupted us, we may as well hear what she has to say." He nodded to his assistant. "Close the door, John. Now, Agent Maddox, did I hear you say you know who's making the threats?"
"Correct." She put a fax picture on Honeymoon's desk. "This is Richard Granger, a hoodlum from Los Angeles who was believed wrongly to have been killed by the mob in 1972.
"And what makes you think he's the culprit?"
"Look at this." She handed him another piece of paper. "Here's the seismograph of a typical earthquake. Look at the vibrations that precede the tremor. There's a haphazard series of different magnitudes.
These are typical foreshocks. She showed him a second sheet. This is the Owens Valley earthquake. Nothing haphazard here. Instead of a natural-looking mess, there is a neat series of regular vibrations.
Hayes interrupted. No one could figure out what those vibrations are.
Judy turned to him.
You couldn't figure it out, but I did.
She put another sheet on Honeymoon's desk.
Look at this chart.
Honeymoon studied the third chart, comparing it with the second.
Regular, just like the Owens Valley graph. What makes vibrations like these?
A machine called a seismic vibrator.
Hayes sniggered, but Honeymoon did not crack a smile.
What's that?
One of these.
She handed him the picture sent to her by the manufacturers.
It's used in oil exploration.
Honeymoon looked skeptical.
Are you saying the earthquake was man-made?
I'm not theorizing. I'm giving you the facts. A seismic vibrator was used in that location immediately before the earthquake. You can make your own judgment about cause and effect.
He gave her a hard, appraising look. He was asking himself whether she was a bullshitter or not. She stared right back at him. Finally, he said,
Okay, how does that lead you to the guy with the beard?
A seismic vibrator was stolen a week ago in Shiloh, Texas.
She heard Hayes say, Oh, shit.
Honeymoon said, And the guy in the picture?
Richard Granger is the prime suspect in the theft, and in the murder of the truck's regular driver. Granger was working for the oil exploration team that was using the vibrator. The EFIT picture is based on the recollections of his co-workers.
Honeymoon nodded. Is that it?
Isn't it enough?
She expostulated.
Honeymoon did not respond to that. He turned to Kincaid.
What have you got to say about all this?
Kincaid gave him a shit-eating grin.
I don't think we should bother you with internal disciplinary matters.
Oh, I want to be bothered,
Honeymoon said.
There was a dangerous note in his voice, and the temperature in the room seemed to fall.
Look at it from my angle. You come here and tell me the earthquake definitely was not man-made.
His voice became louder.
Now it appears from this evidence that it very likely was. So we have a group out there that could cause a major disaster.
Judy felt a surge of triumph as it became clear Honeymoon had bought her story. He was furious with Kincaid. He stood up and pointed a finger at Brian.
You tell me you can't find the perpetrators, then in walks Agent Maddox with a name, a police record, and a fucking picture.
I think I should say,
I feel like you've been dicking me around, Special Agent Kincaid, said Honeymoon, overriding Kincaid.
His face was dark with anger.
And when people dick me around, I get kind of tetchy.
Judy sat silent, watching Honeymoon destroy Kincaid.
If this is what you're like when you're tetchy, Al, I'd hate to see you when you're real mad.
Kincaid tried again.
I'm sorry if...
I also hate people who apologize, Honeymoon said.
An apology is designed to make the offender feel okay so that he can do it again. Don't be sorry.
Kincaid tried to gather the shreds of his dignity.
What do you want me to say?
That you're putting Agent Maddox in charge of this case.
Judy stared at him. This was even better than she had hoped.
Kincaid looked as if he had been asked to strip naked in Union Square.
He swallowed.
Honeymoon said, If you have a problem with that, just say so, and I'll have Governor Robeson call the director of the FBI in Washington. The governor could then explain to the director the reasons why we're making this request.
That won't be necessary, Kincaid said.
So put Maddox in charge.
Okay.
No, not okay. I want you to say it to her, right here, right now.
Brian refused to look at Judy, but he said, Agent Maddox, you are now in charge of the Hammer of Eden investigation.
Thank you, Judy said.
Saved.
Now get out of here, Honeymoon said.
They all got up.
Honeymoon said, Maddox?
She turned at the door.
Yes.
Call me once a day.
That meant he would continue to support her. She could talk to Honeymoon any time she liked, and Kincaid knew it.
You got it, she said.
They went out. As they were leaving the horseshoe, Judy gave Kincaid a sweet smile and repeated the words he had said to her the last time they were in this building, 4 days ago.
"You did just fine in there, Brian. Don't you worry about a thing."
Chapter 13. Dusty was sick all day Monday. Melanie drove into Silver City to pick up more of the allergy drug he needed. She left Dusty being cared for by Flower, who was going through a sudden maternal phase. She came back in a panic. Priest was in the barn with Dale. Dale had asked him to taste the blend of last year's wine. It was going to be a nutty vintage, slow to mature but long-lived. Priest suggested using more of the lighter pressing from the lower, shadier slopes of the valley to make the wine more immediately appealing. But Dale resisted. "This is a connoisseur's wine now," he said. "We don't have to pander to supermarket buyers. Our customers like to keep the wine in their cellars for a few years before drinking it." Priest knew this was not the real reason Dale wanted to talk to him, but he argued anyway. "Don't knock the supermarket buyers. They saved our lives in the early days."
"Well, they can't save our lives now," Dale said. "Priest, why the fuck are we doing this? We have to be off this land by next Sunday."
Priest suppressed a sigh of frustration.
"For Christ's sake, give me a chance. I've almost done it. The governor can't ignore earthquakes indefinitely. I just need a little more time. Why can't you have faith?"
He knew that Dale could not be won over by bullying, cajoling, or bullshit. Only logic would work with him. He forced himself to speak calmly, the epitome of sweet reason. "You could be right," he said magnanimously. Then he could not resist adding a jibe. "Pessimists often are."
"So? All I'm saying to you is give it those 6 days. Don't quit now. Leave time for a miracle. Maybe it won't happen, but maybe it will."
"I don't know," Dale said. Then Melanie burst in with a newspaper in her hand.
"I have to talk to you," she said breathlessly.
Priest's heart missed a beat. What had happened? It must be about the earthquakes, and Dale was not in on the secret. Priest gave him a grin that said, "Ain't women peculiar," and led Melanie out of the barn.
"Dale doesn't know," he said as soon as they were out of earshot. "What the hell? Look at this," she said, waving the paper in front of his eyes.
He was shocked to see a photograph of a seismic vibrator. He hastily scanned the yard and the nearby buildings, but no one was around. All the same, he did not want to have this conversation with Melanie out in the open.
"Not here," he said fiercely. "Put the damn paper under your arm and let's go to my cabin."
She got a grip on herself. They walked through the little settlement to his cabin. As soon as they were inside, he took the newspaper from her and looked at the picture again. There was no doubt about it. He could not read the caption or the accompanying story, of course, but the photo was of a truck just like the one he had stolen.
"Shit," he said, and threw the newspaper on the table.
"Read it," Melanie said.
"It's too dim in here," he replied.
"Tell me what it says."
"The police are looking for a stolen seismic vibrator."
"The hell they are."
"It doesn't say anything about earthquakes," Melanie went on.
"It's just like a funny story. Who'd want to steal one of these damn things?"
"I don't buy that," Priest said. "This can't be a coincidence. The story is about us, even if they don't mention us. They know how we made the earthquake happen, but they haven't told the press yet. They're scared of creating a panic."
"So why have they released this picture?"
"To make things hard for us. That picture makes it impossible to drive the truck on the open road. Every highway patrol officer in California is on the lookout."
He hit the table with his fist in frustration.
"Fuck it, I can't let them stop me this easily."
"What if we drive it at night?" He had thought of that. He shook his head.
"Still too risky. There are cops on the road at night."
"I have to go check on Dusty," Melanie said. She was close to tears. "Oh, Priest, he's so sick. We won't have to leave the valley, will we? I'm scared. I'll never find another place where we can be happy, I know it."
Priest hugged her to give her courage.
"I'm not beaten yet, not by a long shot. What else does the article say?"
She picked up the paper.
"There was a demonstration outside the federal building in San Francisco."
She smiled through her tears.
A group of people who say the Hammer of Eden are right, the FBI should leave us alone, and Governor Robeson should stop building power plants.
Priest was pleased. Well, what do you know? There are still a few Californians who can think straight. Then he became solemn again. But that doesn't help me figure out how to drive the truck without getting pulled over by the first cop who sees it.
I'm going to Dusty, she said.
Priest went with her. In her cabin, Dusty lay on the bed, eyes streaming, face red, panting for breath. Flower sat beside him, reading aloud from a book with a picture of a giant peach on the cover. Priest touched his daughter's hair. She looked up at him and smiled without pausing in her reading. Melanie got a glass of water and gave Dusty a pill. Priest felt sorry for Dusty, but he could not help remembering that the boy's illness was a lucky break for the commune. Melanie was caught in a trap. She believed she had to live where the air was pure, but she could not get a job outside the city. The commune was the only answer. If she had to leave here, she might find another similar commune to take her in, but she might not, and anyway, she was too exhausted and discouraged to hit the road again. And there was more to it than that, he thought. Deep inside her was a terrible rage. He did not know the source of it, but it was strong enough to make her yearn to shake the earth and burn cities and cause people to run screaming from their homes. Most of the time it was hidden beneath the facade of a sexy but disorganized young woman. But sometimes, when her will was thwarted and she felt frustrated and powerless, the anger showed. He left them and headed for Star's cabin, worrying over the problem of the truck. Star might have some ideas. Maybe there was a way they could disguise the seismic vibrator so that it looked like some other kind of vehicle, a coat truck or a crane or something. He stepped into the cabin. Star was putting a band-aid on Ringo's knee, something she had to do about once a day. Priest smiled at his 10-year-old son and said, "What did you do this time, cowboy?" Then he noticed Bones. He was lying on the bed, fully clothed, but fast asleep, or more likely passed out. There was an empty bottle of Silver River Valley Chardonnay on the rough wooden table. Bones's mouth was open, and he was snoring softly. Ringo began to tell Priest a long story about trying to cross the stream by swinging from a tree, but Priest hardly listened. The sight of Bones had given him inspiration, and his mind was working feverishly. When Ringo's grazed knee had been attended to and the boy ran out, Priest told Star about the problem of the seismic vibrator. Then he told her the solution.
This book is continued on Disc 8. Disc 8.
When Ringo's grazed knee had been attended to and the boy ran out, Priest told Star about the problem of the seismic vibrator. Then he told her the solution. Priest, Star, and Oak Tree helped Bones pull the big tarpaulin off the carnival ride. The vehicle stood revealed in its glorious gaudy colors, a green dragon breathing red and yellow fire over three screaming girls in a spinning seat, and the gaudy lettering that Bones had told Priest said, "The Dragon's Mouth." Priest spoke to Oak Tree. "We drive this vehicle up the trackaway and park it next to the seismic vibrator. Then we take off these painted panels and fix them to our truck, covering the machinery. The cops are looking for a seismic vibrator, not a carnival ride." Oak Tree, who was carrying his toolbox, looked closely at the panels, examining the way they were fixed. "No problem," he said after a minute. "I can do it in a day with one or two people helping me."
"And can you put the panels back afterward so that Bones's ride will look the same?"
"Good as new," Oak Tree promised.
Priest looked at Bones. The great snag with this scheme was that Bones had to be in on it. In the old days, Priest would have trusted Bones with his life. He was a rice-eater, after all. Perhaps he could not be relied upon to show up for his own wedding, but he could keep a secret. However, since Bones had become a junkie, all bets were off. Heroin lobotomized people. A junkie would steal his mother's wedding ring. But Priest had to take the risk. He was desperate. He had promised an earthquake 4 days from now, and he had to carry out his threat. Otherwise, all was lost. Bones agreed readily to the plan. priest had half expected him to demand payment. However, he had been living free at the commune for 4 days, so it was too late for him to put his relationship with priest on a commercial footing. Besides, as a communard, Bones knew that the greatest imaginable sin was to value things in money terms. Bones would be more subtle. In a day or two, he would ask priest for cash to go score some smack. Priest would cross that bridge when he came to it. "Let's get to it," he said. Oak Tree and Star climbed into the cab of the carnival ride with Bones. Melanie and Priest took the Cuda for the mile-long ride to where the seismic vibrator was hidden. Priest wondered what else the FBI knew. They had figured out that the earthquake had been triggered using a seismic vibrator. Had they progressed any further? He turned on the car radio, hoping for a bulletin. He got Connie Francis singing "Breakin' in a Brand New Broken Heart," an oldie even by his standards. The Cuda bumped along the muddy track through the forest behind Bones's truck. Bones handled the big rig confidently, Priest observed, even though he had only just been roused from a drunken sleep. There was a moment when Priest felt sure the carnival ride was going to get stuck in a mudslide, but it pulled through without stopping. The news came on just as they drew near the hiding place of the seismic vibrator. Priest turned up the volume. What he heard turned him pale with shock. Federal agents investigating the Hammer of Eden terrorist group have issued a photographic likeness of a suspect, the newsreader said.